This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. Written by Dan Gardner and Philip Tetlock. Performed by Joel Richards.
Visual aids found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you.
Chapter 1. An Optimistic Skeptic. We are all forecasters. When we think about changing jobs, getting married, buying a home, making an investment, launching a product, or retiring, we decide based on how we expect the future will unfold. These expectations are forecasts. Often we do our own forecasting. But when big events happen, markets crash, wars loom, leaders tremble, we turn to the experts, those in the know. We look to people like Tom Friedman. If you are a White House staffer, you might find him in the Oval Office with the President of the United States, talking about the Middle East. If you are a Fortune 500 CEO, you might spot him in Davos, chatting in the lounge with hedge fund billionaires and Saudi princes. And if you don't frequent the White House or swanky Swiss hotels, you can read his New York Times columns and best-selling books that tell you what's happening now, why, and what will come next. Millions do. Like Tom Friedman, Bill Flack forecasts global events. But there's a lot less demand for his insights. For years, Bill worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Arizona. Part pick and shovel work, part spreadsheet. But now he lives in Kearney, Nebraska. Bill is a native Cornhusker. He grew up in Madison, Nebraska, a farm town where his parents owned and published the Madison Star-Mail, a newspaper with lots of stories about local sports and country fairs. He was a good student in high school and went on to get a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Nebraska. From there, he went to the University of Arizona. He was aiming for a PhD in math, but he realized it was beyond his abilities. "I had my nose rubbed in my limitations," is how he puts it, and he dropped out. It wasn't wasted time, however. Classes in ornithology made Bill an avid bird watcher, and because Arizona is a great place to see birds, he did field work part-time for scientists, then got a job with the Department of Agriculture, and stayed for a while. Bill is 55 and retired, although he says if someone offered him a job, he would consider it. So he has free time, and he spends some of it forecasting. Bill has answered roughly 300 questions like, will Russia officially annex additional Ukrainian territory in the next 3 months? And, in the next year, will any country withdraw from the Eurozone? They are questions that matter. And they're difficult. Corporations, banks, embassies, and intelligence agencies struggle to answer such questions all the time. Will North Korea detonate a nuclear device before the end of this year? How many additional countries will report cases of Ebola virus in the next 8 months? Will India or Brazil become a permanent member of the UN Security Council in the next 2 years? Some of the questions are downright obscure, at least for most of us. Will NATO invite new countries to join the Membership Action Plan, MAP, in the next 9 months? Will the Kurdistan Regional Government hold a referendum on national independence this year? If a non-Chinese telecommunications firm wins a contract to provide internet services in the Shanghai Free Trade Zone in the next 2 years, will Chinese citizens have access to Facebook and/or Twitter? When Bill first sees one of these questions, he may have no clue how to answer it. What on earth is the Shanghai Free Trade Zone, you may think? But he does his homework. He gathers facts, balances clashing arguments, and settles on an answer. No one bases decisions on Bill Flack's forecasts or asks Bill to share his thoughts on CNN. He has never been invited to Davos to sit on a panel with Tom Friedman. And that's unfortunate, because Bill Flack is a remarkable forecaster. We know that because each one of Bill's predictions has been dated, recorded, and assessed for accuracy by independent scientific observers. His track record is excellent. Bill is not alone. There are thousands of others answering the same questions, All are volunteers. Most aren't as good as Bill, but about 2% are. They include engineers and lawyers, artists and scientists, Wall Streeters and Main Streeters, professors and students. We will meet many of them, including a mathematician, a filmmaker, and some retirees eager to share their underused talents. I call them super forecasters, because that is what they are. Reliable evidence proves it. Explaining why they're so good and how others can learn to do what they do is my goal in this book. How are low-profile super forecasters compare with cerebral celebrities like Tom Friedman is an intriguing question. But it can't be answered because the accuracy of Friedman's forecasting has never been rigorously tested. Of course, Friedman's fans and critics have opinions one way or the other. He nailed the Arab Spring, or he screwed up on the 2003 invasion of Iraq, or he was prescient on NATO expansion. But there are no hard facts about Tom Friedman's track record, just endless opinions, and opinions on opinions. And that is business as usual. Every day the news media deliver forecasts without reporting or even asking how good the forecasters who made the forecasts really are. Every day, corporations and governments pay for forecasts that may be prescient or worthless or something in between. And every day, all of us, leaders of nations, corporate executives, investors, and voters, make critical decisions on the basis of forecasts whose quality is unknown. Baseball managers wouldn't dream of getting out the checkbook to hire a player without consulting performance statistics. Even fans expect to see player stats on scoreboards and TV screens. And yet, when it comes to the forecasters who help us make decisions that matter far more than any baseball game, we're content to be ignorant. In that light, relying on Bill Flack's forecasts looks quite reasonable. Indeed, relying on the forecasts of many readers of this book may prove quite reasonable, for it turns out that forecasting is not a you-have-it-or-you-don't talent. It's a skill that can be cultivated. This book will show you how. The one about the chimp. I want to spoil the joke, so I'll give away the punchline. The average expert is roughly as accurate as a dart-throwing chimpanzee. You've probably heard that one before. It's famous. In some circles, infamous. It has popped up in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, The Economist, and other outlets around the world. It goes like this. A researcher gathered a big group of experts, academics, pundits, and the like, to make thousands of predictions about the economy, stocks, elections, wars, and other issues of the day. Time passed, and when the researcher checked the accuracy of the predictions, he found that the average expert did about as well as random guessing. Except that's not the punchline, because random guessing isn't funny. The punchline is about a dart-throwing chimpanzee, because chimpanzees are funny. I am that researcher, and for a while I didn't mind the joke. My study was the most comprehensive assessment of expert judgment in the scientific literature. It was a long slog that took about 20 years, from 1984 to 2004, and the results were far richer and more constructive than the punchline suggested. But I didn't mind the joke because it raised awareness of my research. And yes, scientists savor their 15 minutes of fame too. And I myself had used the old dart-throwing chimp metaphor, so I couldn't complain too loudly. I also didn't mind because the joke makes a valid point. Open any newspaper, watch any TV news show, and you find experts who forecast what's coming. Some are cautious. More are bold and confident. A handful claim to be Olympian visionaries able to see decades into the future. With few exceptions, they are not in front of the cameras because they possess any proven skill at forecasting. Accuracy is seldom even mentioned. Old forecasts are like old news, soon forgotten, and pundits are almost never asked to reconcile what they said with what actually happened. The one undeniable talent that talking heads have is their skill at telling a compelling story with conviction, and that is enough. Many have become wealthy peddling forecasting of untested value to corporate executives, government officials, and ordinary people who would never think of swallowing medicine of unknown efficacy and safety, but who routinely pay for forecasts that are as dubious as elixir sold from the back of a wagon. These people, and their customers, deserve a nudge in the ribs. I was happy to see my research used to give it to them. But I realized that as word of my work spread, its apparent meaning was mutating. What my research had shown was that the average expert had done little better than guessing on many of the political and economic questions I had posed. Many does not equal all. It was easiest to beat chance on the shortest-range questions that only required looking 1 year out, and accuracy fell off the further out experts tried to forecast, approaching the dart-throwing chimpanzee level 3 to 5 years out. That was an important finding. It tells us something about the limits of expertise in a complex world, and the limits on what it might be possible for even super forecasters to achieve. But as in the children's game of telephone, in which a phrase is whispered to one child, who passes it on to another, and so on, and everyone is shocked at the end to discover how much it has changed, the actual message was garbled in the constant retelling and the subtleties were lost entirely. The message became, all expert forecasts are useless, which is nonsense. Some variations were even cruder, like, experts know no more than chimpanzees. My research had become a backstop reference for nihilists who see the future as inherently unpredictable and know-nothing populists who insist on proceeding expert with so-called. So I tired of the joke. My research did not support these more extreme conclusions, nor did I feel any affinity for them. Today, that is all the more true. There is plenty of room to stake out reasonable positions between the debunkers and the defenders of experts and their forecasts. On the one hand, the debunkers have a point. There are shady peddlers of questionable insights in the forecasting marketplace. There are also limits to foresight that may just not be surmountable. Our desire to reach into the future will always exceed our grasp. But debunkers go too far when they dismiss all forecasting as a fool's errand. I believe it is possible to see into the future, at least in some situations and to some extent, and that any intelligent, open-minded, and hard-working person can cultivate the requisite skills. Call me an optimistic skeptic. The skeptic. To understand the skeptic half of that label, consider a young Tunisian man pushing a wooden handcart, loaded with fruits and vegetables, down a dusty road to a market in the Tunisian town of Sidi Bouzid. When the man was 3, his father died. He supports his family by borrowing money to fill his cart, hoping to earn enough selling the produce to pay off the debt and have a little left over. It's the same grind every day. But this morning, the police approach the man and say they're going to take his scales because he has violated some regulation. He knows it's a lie. They're shaking him down. But he has no money. A policewoman slaps him and insults his dead father. They take his scales and his cart. The man goes to a town office to complain. He is told the official is busy in a meeting. Humiliated, furious, powerless, the man leaves. He returns with fuel. Outside the town office, he douses himself, lights a match, and burns. Only the conclusion of this story is unusual. There are countless poor street vendors in Tunisia and across the Arab world. Police corruption is rife, and humiliations like those inflicted on this man are a daily occurrence. They matter to no one aside from the police and their victims. But this particular humiliation, on December 17, 2010, caused Muhammad Bouazizi, aged 26, to set himself on fire, and Bouazizi's self-immolation sparked protests. The police responded with typical brutality. The protests spread. Hoping to assuage the public, the dictator of Tunisia, President Zain al-Abidin Ben Ali, visited Bouazizi in the hospital. Bouazizi died on January 4, 2011. The unrest grew. On January 14th, Ben Ali fled to a cushy exile in Saudi Arabia, ending his 23-year kleptocracy. The Arab world watched, stunned. Then protests erupted in Egypt, Libya, Syria, Jordan, Kuwait, and Bahrain. After 3 decades in power, the Egyptian dictator, Hosni Mubarak, was driven from office. Elsewhere, protests swelled into rebellions, rebellions into civil wars. This was the Arab Spring, and it started with one poor man, no different from countless others, being harassed by police, as so many have been, before and since, with no apparent ripple effects. It is one thing to look backward and sketch a narrative arc, as I did here, connecting Mohamed Bouazizi to all the events that flowed out of his lonely protest. Tom Friedman, like many elite pundits, is skilled at that sort of reconstruction, particularly in the Middle East, which he knows so well, having made his name in journalism as a New York Times correspondent in Lebanon. But could even Tom Friedman, if he had been present that fatal morning, have peered into the future and foreseen the self-immolation, the unrest, the toppling of the Tunisian dictator, and all that followed? Of course not. No one could. Maybe, given how much Friedman knew about the region, he would have mused that poverty and unemployment were high, the number of desperate young people was growing, corruption was rampant, repression was relentless, and therefore Tunisia and other Arab countries were powder kegs waiting to blow. But an observer could have drawn exactly the same conclusion the year before, and the year before that. Indeed, you could have said that about Tunisia, Egypt, and several other countries for decades. They may have been powder kegs, but they never blew, until December 17, 2010, when the police pushed that one poor man too far. In 1972, the American meteorologist Edward Lorenz wrote a paper with an arresting title, Predictability. Does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? A decade earlier, Lorenz had discovered by accident that tiny data entry variations in computer simulations of weather patterns, like replacing 0.506127 with 0.506, could produce dramatically different long-term forecasts. It was an insight that would inspire chaos theory. In nonlinear systems, like the atmosphere, even small changes in initial conditions can mushroom to enormous proportions. So, in principle, a lone butterfly in Brazil could flap its wings and set off a tornado in Texas, even though swarms of other Brazilian butterflies could flap frantically their whole lives and never cause a noticeable gust a few miles away. Of course, Lorenz didn't mean that the butterfly causes the tornado in the same sense that I cause a wine glass to break when I hit it with a hammer. He meant that if that particular butterfly hadn't flapped its wings at that moment, the unfathomably complex network of atmospheric actions and reactions would have behaved differently, and the tornado might never have formed, just as the Arab Spring might never have happened, at least not when and as it did, if the police had just let Mohamed Bouazizi sell his fruit and vegetables that morning in 2010. Edward Lorenz shifted scientific opinion toward the view that there are hard limits on predictability, a deeply philosophical question. For centuries, scientists had supposed that growing knowledge must lead to greater predictability, because reality was like a clock, an awesomely big and complicated clock, but still a clock. And the more scientists learned about its innards, how the gears grind together, how the weights and springs function, the better they could capture its operations with deterministic equations and predict what it would do. In 1814, the French mathematician and astronomer Pierre-Simon Laplace took this dream to its logical extreme. We may regard the present state of the universe as the effect of its past and the cause of its future, an intellect which at a certain moment would know all forces that set nature in motion and all positions of all items of which nature is composed. If this intellect were also vast enough to submit these data to analysis, it would embrace in a single formula the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and those of the tiniest atom. For such an intellect, nothing would be uncertain, and the future, just like the past, would be present before its eyes. Laplace called his imaginary entity a demon. If it knew everything about the present, Laplace thought, it could predict everything about the future. It would be omniscient. Lorenz poured cold rainwater on that dream. If the clock symbolizes perfect Laplacian predictability, its opposite is the Lorenzian cloud. High school science tells us that clouds form when water vapor coalesces around dust particles. This sounds simple, but exactly how a particular cloud develops, the shape it takes, depends on complex feedback interactions among droplets. To capture these interactions, computer modelers need equations that are highly sensitive to tiny butterfly effect errors and data collection. So even if we learn all that is knowable about how clouds form, we will not be able to predict the shape a particular cloud will take. We can only wait and see. In one of history's great ironies, scientists today know vastly more than their colleagues a century ago, and possess vastly more data-crunching power, but they are much less confident in the prospects for perfect predictability. This is a big reason for the skeptic half of my optimistic skeptic stance. We live in a world where the actions of one nearly powerless man can have ripple effects around the world, ripples that affect us all to varying degrees. A woman living in a Kansas City suburb may think Tunisia is another planet, and her life has no connection to it. But if she is married to an Air Force navigator who flies out of the nearby Whiteman Air Force Base, she might be surprised to learn that one obscure Tunisian's actions led to protests, that led to riots, that led to the toppling of a dictator, that led to protests in Libya, that led to a civil war, that led to the 2012 NATO intervention, that led to her husband dodging anti-aircraft fire over Tripoli. That's an easily traceable connection. Often the connections are harder to spot, but they are all around us, and things like the price we pay at the gas station or the layoffs down the street. In a world where a butterfly in Brazil can make the difference between just another sunny day in Texas and a tornado tearing through a town, it's misguided to think anyone can see very far into the future. The optimist. But it is one thing to recognize the limits on predictability, and quite another to dismiss all prediction as an exercise in futility. Crank up the microscope on a day in the life of that woman living in a Kansas City suburb. At 6:30 in the morning, she drops papers into a briefcase, gets in her car, drives her usual route to work, and parks downtown. As she does every weekday morning, she walks past the statues of lions and into the Greek-inspired office building of the Kansas City Life Insurance Company. At her desk, she works on spreadsheets for a while, participates in a conference call at 10:30, spends a few minutes browsing on the Amazon website, and answers emails until 11:50. Then she walks to a little Italian restaurant to have lunch with her sister. This woman's life is influenced by many unpredictable factors, from the lottery ticket in her purse, to the Arab Spring that results in her husband flying missions over Libya, to the fact that the price of gas just went up 5 cents a gallon because there was a coup in some country she's never heard of. But there is as much or more that is quite predictable. Why did she leave home at 6:30? She didn't want to get stuck in rush hour. Or to put that another way, she predicted that traffic would be much heavier later, and she was almost certainly right because rush hour is highly predictable. When she drove, she anticipated other drivers' behavior constantly. They will stop at the intersection when the light is red. They will stay in their lanes and signal before turning. She expected the people who said they would join the 10:30 conference call to do so, and she was right. She arranged to meet her sister at noon at the restaurant, because the restaurant's posted hours indicated it would be open then, and posted hours are a reliable guide. We make mundane predictions like these routinely, while others just as routinely make predictions that shape our lives. When the woman turned her computer on, she increased electricity consumption in Kansas City by a bit, as every other worker bee did that morning, and collectively they caused a demand surge, as they do every non-holiday weekday morning around that time. But that didn't cause problems, because electricity producers anticipate these surges and vary their output accordingly. When the woman went to Amazon, the website highlighted certain products it thought she would like, a forecast delivered from her past purchases and browsing, and that of millions of others. We constantly encounter predictive operations like that on the internet. Google personalizes search results by putting what it thinks you will find most interesting on top. But they operate so smoothly, we rarely notice. And then there's the woman's workplace. The Kansas City Life Insurance Company is in the business of forecasting disability and death, and it does a good job. That doesn't mean it knows precisely when I will die, but it does have a good idea of how long someone of my age and profile, sex, income, lifestyle, is likely to live. Kansas City Life was founded in 1895. If its actuaries weren't good forecasters, it would have gone bankrupt long ago. So much of our reality is this predictable, or more so. I just Googled tomorrow's sunrise and sunset times for Kansas City, Missouri, and got them down to the minute. Those forecasts are reliable, whether they are for tomorrow, the day after, or 50 years from now. The same is true of tides, eclipses, and phases of the moon. All can be predicted from clock-like scientific laws with enough precision to satisfy Laplace's forecasting demon. Of course, each of these pockets of predictability can be abruptly punctured. A good restaurant is very likely to open its doors when it says it will, but it may not, for any number of reasons, from a manager sleeping late to fire, bankruptcy, pandemic, nuclear war, or a physics experiment accidentally creating a black hole that sucks up the solar system. The same is true of anything else. Even those 50-year sunrise and sunset forecasts could be off somewhat if sometime in the next 50 years, a massive space rock bumps Earth off its orbit around the sun. There are no certainties in life, not even death and taxes, if we assign a non-zero probability to the invention of technologies that let us upload the contents of our brains into a cloud computing network, and the emergence of a future society so public-spirited and prosperous that the state can be funded with charitable donations. So is reality clock-like or cloud-like? Is the future predictable or not? These are false dichotomies, the first of many we will encounter. We live in a world of clocks and clouds and a vast jumble of other metaphors. Unpredictability and predictability coexist uneasily in the intricately interlocking systems that make up our bodies, our societies, and the cosmos. How predictable something is depends on what we are trying to predict, how far into the future, and under what circumstances. Look at Edward Lorenz's field. Weather forecasts are typically quite reliable under most conditions, looking a few days ahead. But they become increasingly less accurate 3, 4, and 5 days out. Much beyond a week, we might as well consult that dart-throwing chimpanzee. So we can't say that weather is predictable or not, only that weather is predictable to some extent under some circumstances. And we must be very careful when we try to be more precise than that. Take something as seemingly simple as the relationship between time and predictability. It is generally true that the further we try to look into the future, the harder it is to see. But there can be prolonged exceptions to that rule. Predicting the continuation of a long bull market in stocks can prove profitable for many years, until it suddenly proves to be your undoing. And predicting that dinosaurs would continue to preside at the top of the food chain was a safe bet for tens of millions of years, until an asteroid set off a cataclysm that opened up ecological niches for a tiny mammal that eventually evolved into a species that tries to predict the future. Laws of physics aside, there are no universal constants, so separating the predictable from the unpredictable is difficult work. There's no way around it. Meteorologists know that better than anyone. They make large numbers of forecasts and routinely check their accuracy, which is why we know that 1 and 2 day forecasts are typically quite accurate, while 8 day forecasts are not. With these analyses, meteorologists are able to sharpen their understanding of how weather works and tweak their models. Then they try again. Forecast, measure, revise, repeat. It's a never-ending process of incremental improvement that explains why weather forecasts are good and slowly getting better. There may be limits to such improvements, however, because weather is the textbook illustration of nonlinearity. The further out the forecaster tries to look, the more opportunity there is for chaos to flap its butterfly wings and blow away expectations. Big leaps in computing power and continued refinement of forecasting models may nudge the limits a little further into the future, but those advances gradually get harder, and the payoffs shrink toward zero. How good can it get? No one knows. But knowing the current limits is itself a success. In so many other high-stakes endeavors, forecasters are groping in the dark. They have no idea how good their forecasts are in the short, medium, or long term, and no idea how good their forecasts could become. At best, they have vague hunches. That's because the forecast measure revise procedure operates only within the rarefied confines of high-tech forecasting, such as the work of macroeconomists at central banks, or marketing and financial professionals in big companies, or opinion poll analysts like Nate Silver. More often, forecasts are made and then nothing. Accuracy is seldom determined after the fact, and is almost never done with sufficient regularity and rigor that conclusions can be drawn. The reason? Mostly it's a demand-side problem. The consumers of forecasting, governments, businesses, and the public, don't demand evidence of accuracy. So there is no measurement, which means no revision. And without revision, there can be no improvement. Imagine a world in which people love to run, but they have no idea how fast the average person runs or how fast the best could run. Because runners have never agreed to basic ground rules, stay on the track, begin the race when the gun is fired, end it after a specified distance, and there are no independent race officials and timekeepers measuring results, how likely is it that running times are improving in this world? Not very. Are the best runners running as fast as human beings are physically capable? Again, probably not. I have been struck by how important measurement is to improving the human condition, Bill Gates wrote. You can achieve incredible progress if you set a clear goal and find a measure that will drive progress toward that goal. This may seem basic, but it is amazing how often it is not done and how hard it is to get right. He is right about what it takes to drive progress, and it is surprising how rarely it's done in forecasting. Even that simple first step, setting a clear goal, hasn't been taken. You might think the goal of forecasting is to foresee the future accurately, but that's often not the goal, or at least not the sole goal. Sometimes forecasts are meant to entertain. Think of CNBC's Jim Cramer and his booyah shtick, or John McLaughlin, the host of the McLaughlin Group, bellowing at his panelists to predict the likelihood of an event. On a scale from 0 to 10, with 0 representing zero possibility and 10 representing complete metaphysical certitude. Sometimes forecasts are used to advance political agendas and galvanize action, as activists hope to do when they warn of looming horrors unless we change our ways. There is also dress-to-impress forecasting, which is what banks deliver when they pay a famous pundit to tell wealthy clients about the global economy in 2050. And some forecasts are meant to comfort, by assuring the audience that their beliefs are correct and the future will unfold as expected. Partisans are fond of these forecasts. They are the cognitive equivalent of slipping into a warm bath. This jumble of goals is seldom acknowledged, which makes it difficult to even start working toward measurement and progress. It's a messy situation, which doesn't seem to be getting better. And yet, this stagnation is a big reason why I am an optimistic skeptic. We know that in so much of what people want to predict, politics, economics, finance, business, technology, daily life, predictability exists, to some degree, in some circumstances. But there is so much else we do not know. For scientists, not knowing is exciting. It's an opportunity to discover. The more that is unknown, the greater the opportunity. Thanks to the frankly quite amazing lack of rigor in so many forecasting domains, this opportunity is huge. And to seize it, all we have to do is set a clear goal, accuracy, and get serious about measuring. I've been doing that for much of my career. The research that produced the dart-throwing chimpanzee result was phase one. Phase two started in the summer of 2011, when my research and life partner Barbara Mellers and I launched the Good Judgment Project and invited volunteers to sign up and forecast the future. Bill Flack responded. So did a couple of thousand others that first year, and thousands more in the 4 years that followed. Cumulatively, more than 20,000 intellectually curious laypeople tried to figure out if protests in Russia would spread, the price of gold would plummet, the Nikkei would close above 9,500, war would erupt on the Korean Peninsula, and many other questions about complex, challenging global issues. By varying the experimental conditions, we could gauge which factors improved foresight, by how much, over which time frames, and how good forecasts could be if best practices were layered on each other. Laid out like that, it sounds simple. It wasn't. It was a demanding program that took the talents and hard work of a multidisciplinary team based at the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Pennsylvania. Big as it was, the Good Judgment Project, GJP, was only part of a much larger research effort sponsored by the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, IARPA. Don't be put off by the bland name. IARPA is an agency within the intelligence community that reports to the Director of National Intelligence, and its job is to support daring research that promises to make American intelligence better at what it does. And a big part of what American intelligence does is forecast global political and economic trends. By one rough estimate, the United States has 20,000 intelligence analysts assessing everything from minute puzzles to major events such as the likelihood of an Israeli sneak attack on Iranian nuclear facilities or the departure of Greece from the Eurozone. How good is all this forecasting? That is not easily answered because the intelligence community, like so many major producers of forecasting, has never been keen on spending money to figure that out. There are various reasons for that reluctance, some more respectable than others, but we'll get into that later. What matters is that this forecasting is critical to national security, and yet little can be said with any confidence about how good it is, or even whether it's as good as a multi-billion dollar operation with 20,000 people should be. To change that, IARPA created a forecasting tournament in which five scientific teams led by top researchers in the field would compete to generate accurate forecasts on the sorts of tough questions intelligence analysts deal with every day. The Good Judgment Project was one of those five teams. Each team would effectively be its own research project, free to improvise whatever methods it thought would work, but required to submit forecasts at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time every day from September 2011 to June 2015. By requiring teams to forecast the same questions at the same time, the tournament created a level playing field and a rich trove of data about what works, how well, and when. Over 4 years, IARPA posed nearly 500 questions about world affairs. Time frames were shorter than in my earlier research, with a vast majority of forecasts extending out more than 1 month and less than 1 year. In all, we gathered over 1 million individual judgments about the future. In year one, GJP beat the official control group by 60%. In year two, we beat the control group by 78%. GJP also beat its university-affiliated competitors, including the University of Michigan and MIT, by hefty margins, from 30% to 70%, and even outperformed professional intelligence analysts with access to classified data. After 2 years, GJP was doing so much better than its academic competitors that IARPA dropped the other teams. I'll delve into details later, but let's note two key conclusions that emerge from this research. One, foresight is real. Some people like Bill Flack, have it in spades. They aren't gurus or oracles with the power to peer decades into the future, but they do have a real, measurable skill at judging how high-stakes events are likely to unfold 3 months, 6 months, a year, or a year and a half in advance. The other conclusion is what makes these super forecasters so good. It's not really who they are, it's what they do. Foresight isn't a mysterious gift bestowed at birth. It is the product of particular ways of thinking, of gathering information, of updating beliefs. These habits of thought can be learned and cultivated by any intelligent, thoughtful, determined person. It may not even be all that hard to get started. One result that particularly surprised me was the effect of a tutorial covering some basic concepts that we'll explore in this book and are summarized in the Ten Commandments appendix. It took only about 60 minutes to read, and yet it improved accuracy by roughly 10% through the entire tournament year. Yes, 10% may sound modest, but it was achieved at so little cost. And never forget that even modest improvements in foresight maintained over time add up. I spoke about that with Aaron Brown, an author, a Wall Street veteran, and the chief risk manager at AQR Capital Management, a hedge fund with over $100 billion in assets. "It's so hard to see because it's not dramatic," he said. "But if it is sustained, it's the difference between a consistent winner who's making a living or the guy who's going broke all the time." A world-class poker player we will meet soon could not agree more. "The difference between heavyweights and amateurs," she said, "is that the heavyweights know the difference between a 60-40 bet and a 40-60 bet." And yet, if it's possible to improve foresight simply by measuring, and if the rewards of improved foresight are substantial, why isn't measuring standard practice? A big part of the answer to that question lies in the psychology that convinces us we know things we really don't. Things like whether Tom Friedman is an accurate forecaster or not. I'll explore this psychology in Chapter 2. For centuries, it hobbled progress in medicine. When physicians finally accepted that their experience and perceptions were not reliable means of determining whether a treatment works, they turned to scientific testing, and medicine finally started to make rapid advances. The same revolution needs to happen in forecasting. It won't be easy. Chapter 3 examines what it takes to test forecasting as rigorously as modern medicine tests treatments. It's a bigger challenge than it may appear. In the late 1980s, I worked out a methodology and conducted what was, at the time, the biggest test of expert political forecasting accuracy ever. One result, delivered many years later, was the punchline that now makes me squirm. But another discovery of that research didn't receive nearly as much attention, even though it was far more important. One group of experts had modest but real foresight. What made the difference between the experts with foresight and those who were so hopeless they dragged the average down to the level of a dart-throwing chimp? It wasn't some mystical gift or access to information others didn't have, nor was it any particular set of beliefs. Indeed, within a quite wide range of views, what they thought didn't matter. It was how they thought. Inspired in part by that insight, IARPA created its unprecedented forecasting tournament. Chapter 4 is the story of how that happened, and the discovery of super forecasters. Why are they so good? That question runs through chapters 5 through 9. When you meet them, it's not hard to be struck by how smart they are. So you might suspect it's intelligence that makes all the difference. It's not. They're also remarkably numerate. Like Bill Flack, many have advanced degrees in mathematics and science. So is the secret arcane math? No. Even super forecasters who are card-carrying mathematicians rarely use much math. They also tend to be news junkies who stay on top of the latest developments and regularly update their forecasts. So you might be tempted to attribute their success to spending endless hours on the job. Yet that, too, would be a mistake. Super forecasting does require minimum levels of intelligence, numeracy, and knowledge of the world, but anyone who reads serious books about psychological research probably has those prerequisites. So what is it that elevates forecasting to super forecasting? As with the experts who had real foresight in my earlier research, what matters most is how the forecaster thinks. I'll describe this in detail, but broadly speaking, super forecasting demands thinking that is open-minded, careful, curious, and, above all, self-critical. It also demands focus. The kind of thinking that produces superior judgment does not come effortlessly. Only the determined can deliver it reasonably consistently, which is why our analyses have consistently found commitment to self-improvement to be the strongest predictor of performance. In the final chapters, I'll resolve an apparent contradiction between the demands of good judgment and effective leadership, respond to what I think are the two strongest challenges to my research, and conclude, appropriately for a book about forecasting, with a consideration of what comes next. A forecast about forecasting. But maybe you think this is all hopelessly outdated. After all, we live in an era of dazzlingly powerful computers, incomprehensible algorithms, and big data. At its core, the forecasting I study involves subjective judgment. It is people thinking and deciding, nothing more. Isn't the time for such sloppy guesswork drawing to a close? In 1954, a brilliant psychologist, Paul Meehl, wrote a small book that caused a big stir. It reviewed 20 studies showing that well-informed experts predicting outcomes, whether a student would succeed in college or a parolee would be sent back to prison, were not as accurate as simple algorithms that added up objective indicators like ability test scores and records of past conduct. Meehl's claim upset many experts, but subsequent research, now more than 200 studies, has shown that in most cases, statistical algorithms beat subjective judgment. And in the handful of studies where they don't, they usually tie. Given that algorithms are quick and cheap, unlike subjective judgment, a tie supports using the algorithm. The point is now indisputable. When you have a well-validated statistical algorithm, use it. This insight was never a threat to the reign of subjective judgment, because we so rarely have well-validated algorithms for the problem at hand. It was just impractical for math to displace plain old thinking in 1954 and even today. But spectacular advances in information technology suggest we are approaching a historical discontinuity in humanity's relationship with machines. In 1997, IBM's Deep Blue beat chess champion Garry Kasparov. Now, commercially available chess programs can beat any human. In 2011, IBM's Watson beat Jeopardy champions Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter. That was a vastly tougher computing challenge, but Watson's engineers did it. Today, it's no longer impossible to imagine a forecasting competition in which a supercomputer trounces super forecasters and super pundits alike. After that happens, there will still be human forecasters, but like human Jeopardy contestants, we will only watch them for entertainment. So I spoke to Watson's chief engineer, David Ferrucci. I was sure that Watson could easily field a question about the present or past, like, which two Russian leaders traded jobs in the last 10 years? But I was curious about his views on how long it will take for Watson, or one of its digital descendants, to field questions like, will two top Russian leaders trade jobs in the next 10 years? In 1965, the polymath Herbert Simon thought we were only 20 years away from a world in which machines could do any work a man can do, which is the sort of naively optimistic thing people said back then, and one reason why Ferrucci, who has worked in artificial intelligence for 30 years, is more cautious today. Computing is making enormous strides, Ferrucci noted. The ability to spot patterns is growing spectacularly, and machine learning, in combination with burgeoning human-machine interactions that feed the learning process, promises far more fundamental advances to come. It's going to be one of these exponential curves that we're kind of at the bottom of now, Ferrucci said. But there is a vast difference between which two Russian leaders traded jobs and will two Russian leaders trade jobs again? The former is a historical fact. The computer can look it up. The latter requires the computer to make an informed guess about the intentions of Vladimir Putin, the character of Dmitry Medvedev, and the causal dynamics of Russian politics, and then integrate that information into a judgment call. People do that sort of thing all the time, but that doesn't make it easy. It means the human brain is wondrous, because the task is staggeringly hard. Even with computers making galloping advances, the sort of forecasting that super forecasters do is a long way off. And Ferrucci isn't sure we will ever see a human under glass at the Smithsonian with a sign saying, subjective judgment. Machines may be getting better at mimicking human meaning and thereby better at predicting human behavior, but there's a difference between mimicking and reflecting meaning and originating meaning, Ferrucci said. That's a space human judgment will always occupy. In forecasting, as in other fields, we will continue to see human judgment being displaced, to the consternation of white-collar workers, but we will also see more and more syntheses, like freestyle chess, in which humans and computers compete as teams, the human drawing on the computer's indisputable strengths, but also occasionally overriding the computer. The result is a combination that can, sometimes, beat both humans and machines. To reframe the man versus machine dichotomy, combinations of Garry Kasparov and Deep Blue may prove more robust than pure human or pure machine approaches. What Ferrucci does see becoming obsolete is the guru model that makes so many policy debates so puerile. I'll counter your Paul Krugman polemic with my Neil Ferguson counter-polemic, and rebut your Tom Friedman op-ed with my Brett Stevens blog. Ferrucci sees light at the end of this long, dark tunnel. I think it's going to get stranger and stranger for people to listen to the advice of experts whose views are informed only by their subjective judgment. Human thought is beset by psychological pitfalls, a fact that has only become widely recognized in the last decade or two. So what I want is that human expert paired with a computer to overcome the human cognitive limitations and biases. If Ferrucci is right, and I suspect he is, we will need to blend computer-based forecasting and subjective judgment in the future. So it's time we got serious about both. Chapter 2. Illusions of Knowledge. When the dermatologist saw spots on the back of the patient's hand, he was suspicious and removed a bit of skin. A pathologist confirmed it was a basal cell carcinoma. The patient didn't panic. He too was a physician. He knew this form of cancer seldom spreads. The carcinoma was removed, and as a precaution, the patient arranged to see a big-name specialist. The specialist discovered a lump in the patient's right armpit, or axilla. How long had it been there? The patient didn't know. The specialist said it should come out. The patient agreed. After all, the specialist was a renowned figure. If he said, take it out, who would disagree? The surgery was booked. When the anesthesia wore off and the patient awoke, he was surprised to find his whole chest wrapped in bandages. The specialist arrived. His expression was grim. I must tell you the truth, he began. Your axilla is full of cancerous tissue. I've done my best to excise it and have removed your pectoralis minor, but I may well not have saved your life. That last statement was a modest attempt to soften the blow. As the specialist made all too clear, the patient hadn't long to live. For a moment the world seemed to end, the patient later wrote. After a short period of surprise and shock, I turned as far as I could on my side and sobbed unashamedly. I do not remember much about the rest of the day. The next morning, with a clear mind, I worked out a simple plan of how I would spend my remaining time. A curious feeling of peace came over me when I had completed the plan, and I fell asleep. In the days that followed, visitors came to offer the patient whatever comfort they could. He found it all rather awkward. It was soon clear that they were more embarrassed than I was, he wrote. He was dying. That was a fact. One had to keep calm and do what one must. There was no use blubbering. This melancholy moment happened in 1956, but the patient, Archie Cochrane, did not die, which is fortunate because he went on to become a revered figure in medicine. The specialist was wrong. Cochrane didn't have terminal cancer. He didn't have cancer at all, as a pathologist discovered when he examined the tissue removed during surgery. Cochrane was as shocked by his reprieve as by his death sentence. I had been told that the pathologist had not yet reported, he wrote many years later, but I never doubted the surgeon's words. That's the problem. Cochrane didn't doubt the specialist, and the specialist didn't doubt his own judgment, and so neither man considered the possibility that the diagnosis was wrong, and neither thought it wise to wait for the pathologist's report before closing the books on the life of Archie Cochrane. But we shouldn't judge them too harshly. It's human nature. We have all been too quick to make up our minds and too slow to change them. And if we don't examine how we make these mistakes, we will keep making them. This stagnation can go on for years, or a lifetime. It can even last centuries, as the long and wretched history of medicine illustrates. Blind men arguing. The long part is obvious enough. People have been trying to make the sick well for as long as people have been getting sick. But wretched? That is less obvious, even for readers familiar with the history of medicine, because Most histories of medicine are strikingly odd, as the British physician and author Drewin Birch noted. They provide a clear account of what people believe they were doing, but almost none at all of whether they were right. Did the ostrich egg poultices applied by ancient Egyptian physicians actually heal head fractures? In ancient Mesopotamia, did the treatments of the keeper of the royal rectum actually keep royal rectums healthy? What about bloodletting? Everyone from the ancient Greeks to George Washington's doctors swore that it was wonderfully restorative. But did it work? The standard histories are usually mute on these scores. But when we use modern science to judge the efficacy of historical treatments, it becomes depressingly clear that most of the interventions were useless or worse. Until quite recently, in historical terms, it was not unusual for a sick person to be better off if there was no physician available, because letting an illness take its natural course was less dangerous than what a physician would inflict. And treatments seldom got better, no matter how much time passed. When George Washington fell ill in 1799, his esteemed physicians bled him relentlessly, dosed him with mercury to cause diarrhea, induced vomiting, and raised blood-filled blisters by applying hot cups to the old man's skin. A physician in Aristotle's Athens, or Nero's Rome, or medieval Paris, or Elizabethan London, would have nodded at much of that hideous regime. Washington died. One might assume that such results would make physicians question their methods, but, to be fair, the fact that Washington died proves nothing about the treatments beyond that they failed to prevent his death. It's possible that the treatments helped, but not enough to overcome the disease that took Washington's life, or that they didn't help at all, or that the treatments even hastened Washington's death. It's impossible to know which of these conclusions is true merely by observing that one outcome. Even with many such observations, the truth can be difficult or impossible to tease out. There are just too many factors involved, too many possible explanations, too many unknowns. And if physicians are already inclined to think the treatments work, which they are, or they wouldn't prescribe them, all that ambiguity is likely to be read in favor of the happy conclusion that the treatments really are effective. It takes strong evidence and more rigorous experimentation than the bleed the patient and see if he gets better variety to overwhelm preconceptions. And that was never done. Consider Galen, the second century physician to Roman emperors. No one has influenced more generations of physicians. Galen's writings were the indisputable source of medical authority for more than 1,000 years. "It is I, and I alone, who has revealed the true path of medicine," Galen wrote with his usual modesty. And yet Galen never conducted anything resembling a modern experiment. Why should he? Experiments are what people do when they aren't sure what the truth is. And Galen was untroubled by doubt. Each outcome confirmed he was right, no matter how equivocal the evidence might look to someone less wise than the master. "All who drink of this treatment recover in a short time, except those whom it does not help, who all die," he wrote. "It is obvious, therefore, that it fails only in incurable cases." Galen is an extreme example, but he is the sort of figure who pops up repeatedly in the history of medicine. They are men, always men, of strong conviction and a profound trust in their own judgment. They embrace treatments, develop bold theories for why they work, denounce rivals as quacks and charlatans, and spread their insights with evangelical passion. So it went from the ancient Greeks to Galen, to Paracelsus, to the German Samuel Hahnemann, and the American Benjamin Rush. In the 19th century, American medicine saw pitched battles between orthodox physicians and a host of charismatic figures with curious new theories like Thomsonianism, which posited that most illness was due to an excess of cold in the body, or the orificial surgery of Edwin Hartley Pratt, whose fundamental insight was that, as one detractor put it, with only modest exaggeration, "The rectum is the focus of existence, contains the essence of life, and performs the functions ordinarily ascribed to the heart and brain." Fringe or mainstream, almost all of it was wrong, with the treatments on offer ranging from the frivolous to the dangerous. Some physicians feared as much, but most carried on with business as usual. ignorance and confidence remain defining features of medicine. As the surgeon and historian Ira Rutkoff observed, physicians who furiously debated the merits of various treatments and theories were like blind men arguing over the colors of the rainbow. The cure for this plague of certainty came tantalizing close to discovery in 1747, when a British ship's doctor named James Lind took 12 sailors suffering from scurvy, divided them into pairs, and gave each pair a different treatment. Vinegar, cider, sulfuric acid, seawater, a bark paste, and citrus fruit. It was an experiment born of desperation. Scurvy was a mortal threat to sailors on long-distance voyages, and not even the confidence of physicians could hide the futility of their treatments. So Lind took 6 shots in the dark, and 1 hit. The 2 sailors given the citrus recovered quickly. But contrary to popular belief, this was not a eureka moment that ushered in the modern era of experimentation. Lind was behaving in what sounds a modern way, but had no full understanding of what he was doing, noted Druin Birch. He failed so completely to make sense of his own experiment that even he was left unconvinced of the exceptional benefits of lemons and limes. For years thereafter, sailors kept getting scurvy, and doctors kept prescribing worthless medicine. Not until the 20th century did the idea of randomized trial experiments, careful measurement, and statistical power take hold. Is the application of the numerical method to the subject matter of medicine a trivial and time-wasting ingenuity, as some hold? Or is it an important stage in the development of our art, as others proclaim it? The Lancet asked in 1921. The British statistician Austin Bradford Hill responded emphatically that it was the latter, and laid out a template for modern medical investigation. If patients who were identical in every way were put into 2 groups, and the groups were treated differently, he wrote, we would know the treatment caused any difference in outcome. It seems simple, but is impossible in practice because no 2 people are exactly alike, not even identical twins. So the experiment will be confounded by the differences among test subjects. The solution lay in statistics. Randomly assigning people to one group or the other would mean whatever differences there were among them should balance out if enough people participated in the experiment. Then we can confidently conclude that the treatment caused any differences in observed outcomes. It isn't perfect. There is no perfection in our messy world, but it beats wise men stroking their chins. This seems stunningly obvious today. Randomized controlled trials are now routine. Yet it was revolutionary because medicine had never before been scientific. True, it had occasionally reaped the fruits of science, like the germ theory of disease and the X-ray, and it dressed up as a science. There were educated men with impressive titles who conducted case studies and reported results in Latin-laden lectures at august universities. But it wasn't scientific. It was cargo cult science, a term of mockery coined much later by the physicist Richard Feynman to describe what happened after American air bases from World War II were removed from remote South Pacific islands, ending the islanders' only contact with the outside world. The planes had brought wondrous goods. The islanders wanted more. So they arranged to make things like runways, to put fires along the sides of the runways, to make a wooden hut for a man to sit in, with 2 wooden pieces on his head like headphones, and bars of bamboo sticking out like antennas. He's the controller, and they wait for the planes to land. But the planes never returned. So cargo cult science has the outward form of science, but lacks what makes it truly scientific. What medicine lacked was doubt. Doubt is not a fearful thing, Feynman observed, but a thing of very great value. It's what propels science forward. When the scientist tells you he does not know the answer, he is an ignorant man. When he tells you he has a hunch about how it is going to work, he is uncertain about it. When he is pretty sure of how it is going to work, and he tells you, this is the way it's going to work, I'll bet, he still is in some doubt. And it is of paramount importance, in order to make progress, that we recognize this ignorance and this doubt. Because we have the doubt, we then propose looking in new directions for new ideas. The rate of the development of science is not the rate at which you make observations alone, but, much more important, the rate at which you create new things to test. It was the absence of doubt and scientific rigor that made medicine unscientific and caused it to stagnate for so long. Putting medicine to the test. Unfortunately,